Hello, everyone, and welcome to the first in a series of podcasts from Freshfields International Arbitration Group. My name is Noah Rubens. I am the head of the International Arbitration Practice in the Paris office, and today I am joined by my partners Caroline Richard from the Washington, D.C. office.
Yes, hello.
And Nick Lingard from our Singapore office.
Hi, Noah. Hi, everybody.
10 years ago, it was quite rare that we would have funding from an exterior source for our clients. But today, the third-party funding market has become very complicated, very sophisticated, originating as it did in litigation in Australia and spreading to the United Kingdom and then into the international arbitration market, now pretty much throughout the world. The market players have also multiplied, starting from specialized litigation funds and spreading to commercial banks and private equity funds. Now, what we're going to talk about today is the complexity of the legal and regulatory and contracting practices that surround third-party funding in arbitration. For our clients, it's extremely important that we understand how the market works. It's certainly not something that's written down somewhere in some guidebook. So I thought perhaps that we would start with some general points about how one arrives at funding. How do we get funding? How do our clients get funding? How do we help them to get funding? And maybe, Caroline, you can start by walking us through some of the steps that one typically goes through in finding a funder and getting funding into place.
The first step, obviously, is to identify funders to approach. Often it's in our clients' interest to reach out to multiple funders to canvass their interest. Different funders can be better suited to funding a case depending on the jurisdiction involved, the type of funding, the amount of funding that's required. And so by reaching out to several funders initially, you can have more of a competitive process. And I should mention there are also brokers out there that specialize in helping litigants find the right funder. And once you've identified one or more funders, before disclosing information relating to the claim, it's very important to put in place appropriate non-disclosure and confidentiality agreements, not least to avoid waiving privilege. And then once that's in place, funders will carry out due diligence into the claim to determine that the case meets their investment criteria. Then if one or more funders are interested in the case, they'll offer heads of terms. And then typically, this is followed by a period of exclusivity with the funder that your client selects, who will carry out an in-depth due diligence. Obviously, one of the key factors is the merits of the case. Funders typically have high thresholds for the likelihood of success of the claims that they fund, and they often use arbitration lawyers, either in-house or external counsel, to advise them on the merits of the claim. But there are other factors that they look into as well. Nick, maybe you can talk about some of those.
The starting place, of course, as Caroline has said, is the merits of the case. And a funder's threshold is likely pretty high. They want to invest in a good claim. But what comes next? A funder will want to look very closely at the quantum of the claim. What is the claim worth? It is no good for a funder investing in a claim that legally is highly meritorious but has a relatively small pot of money for recovery available at the end of that claim. So a very robust assessment of the quantum of the claim is a very important part of this early assessment. It's a rule of thumb, but one way of looking at this is a ratio of something like 1 to 10, where 1 is a realistic estimate of the amount the funder will have to invest to pursue the claim, fees, costs, and so on, and 10 is the realistic recovery of quantum in the case. Very closely related to that is the likelihood of recovery. What is the capacity of the defendant respondent to pay the award? And that will require an assessment of its assets, where they are, and the ability of enforcing against them, a mixed analysis of fact and law. And many funders have very sophisticated enforcement arms whose principal business is enforcing awards. Next, funders will want to look at how long all of this is going to take. Finally, though, we, of course, would say by no means least importantly, it will be critical for sophisticated funders to look at the track record of the council involved working with funders, but more importantly, in achieving results in the sorts of case that the funder is considering investing in. Now, all of those economic factors will feed into the commercial terms that a funder is willing to offer. But in traditional model financing, broadly speaking, we see two models, and sometimes the two combined. One is a multiple of the amount invested. That is, the funder recovers X of the amount it has spent on the case. Another is a percentage of the recovery operating through some waterfall. So up to threshold X, funder recovers percentage Y. Above that, as I've said, we will often see a combination of those two for recovery at different points over the time horizon and different value of the claim.
I mentioned before that the third-party funding market has developed very quickly over the last few years. And markets, as they mature, they can go in two different directions, towards uniformity and towards diversity. My sense is that this is a market that is not becoming more uniform, but is becoming more diverse.
That certainly mirrors my experience. We see huge diversity, both in terms of sources of funding, the funders active in the market, and the models they are willing to adopt to invest in international arbitration. I think several years ago, most of us working with funded cases worked with a relatively small number of specialists. We now see a much more diverse range of players, from traditional finance houses. We see insurers active. We see some investment banks active, both with their clients' money and on an own account basis. And we do some advising for houses of that sort in establishing funds. We also see hedge funds active in the space, where hedge funds historically had deployed some capital into the first phase standalone specialist funders I described. We now see some hedge funds funding cases directly on an own account basis. And the same is true in terms of diversity of models of funding. I described a very traditional model of a funder advancing funds in return for either a multiple of the amount invested or a percentage of the client's recovery in the case. That still certainly is an important model, but there are many others. We see some funders willing to take equity in a claimant entity, either become a or the shareholder in an entity, which is gaining popularity for particular sorts of claimants where they may have a very large asset, but that has been interfered with improperly by, for example, a regulator or a government, and the funder takes equity in that company, enabling the company thereby to bring its treaty claim. Finally, I'd say from where I sit in Singapore, the big development, and I think has been the liberalization of the market for third-party funding. Though key sources of cases and indeed capital in this part of the world have long been unregulated as to third-party funding. That remains true of Japan, Korea, China. There is no official prohibition, nor is there an official allowance of funding. There is some ambiguity in those places and careful structuring required. But in the two key arbitration centers in Asia, Hong Kong and Singapore, in the past 18 months, we've seen liberalization so that there is express permission for third-party funding in international arbitration subject to statutory conditions. And that has developed, I think, for funders' real interest in this part of the world.
Let's turn to some of the legal and regulatory issues related to third-party funding, this amazing new source of capital for legal representation and defense of claims doesn't come without its tricky bits. And it seems to me there are at least three central issues that counsel have to deal with on a day-to-day basis in a funded case. The first is the remaining lingering aspects of something called champerty, which is a common law term that once limited the provision of funds to advance someone else's case. Second is the ethical considerations that arise in this trilateral, triangular relationship between counsel, client, and funder. And the third is the question of disclosing the presence of a funder in an arbitration case and the extent to which the terms of funding as well as the existence of funding need to be disclosed. Maybe we start with you, Nick, and that lingering tale of Champerty. What is the remaining restriction with respect to the funder's control over a claim?
There remains some diversity. I should say there are some common law jurisdictions where Champerty remains prohibited. Ireland is the key one. In most others, it has been removed one way or another, either by statute or operation of common law. But where the rubber hits the road with this issue, it seems to me, is in the nub of your question, Noah, is control. Who gets to control the pursuit of the litigation? If a company signs up for third-party funding of an international arbitration, is it thereby signing away control over the pursuit of the litigation? And the short answer is no, both for practical and ethical reasons. Those funders that are self-regulated by an English body called the Association of Litigation Funders agree to be bound by a code of conduct, which has really added as its linchpin that the client and not the funder controls the course of the litigation. But there are many very effective, very ethical funders that are not a member of that organization. And with those two, control continues to lie with the party to the arbitration, not the funder. And that is potentially critical for many clients in the context of settlement. One of the questions we frequently are asked is who gets to decide settlement? If a settlement is on the table, who gets to decide it and who gets to advise me on it? And the answer is the company gets to decide it, advised by its counsel in the ordinary way. Now, of course, there are economic consequences of that decision. If that results in an inflow of capital, then there will be funds due to the funder in accordance with the terms of the funding agreement. But that's an ordinary commercial decision to be made in the ordinary way by the client. It remains the client's decision, both as a matter of theory and practice.
Whose system of law applies to that question of acceptable control? Is it the law of the place where the funder is located, or the law of the place where the client is located, the seat of the arbitration?
That's a vexed question, Noah, and a prudent client with prudent counsel would be looking at each of those possible sources, because what ultimately we want to do for our clients is protect the integrity of the proceedings and the enforceability of the award they get at the end of it. So we would want to work through the list you just offered and work out if there is a potential regulatory impediment in any place that might touch the arbitration and critically might touch the enforcement of the arbitration. But there is no single answer, unfortunately, to that question.
Caroline, there's a related ethical issue in relation to control. How do we deal with the client-lawyer relationship when there is this third party who has a vested interest in the conduct of the arbitration and in the outcome of the arbitration, and who no doubt would like to influence the decisions that are made in terms of the prosecution of the case?
I think it's important to clearly distinguish between the client, who is taking the decisions with respect to the arbitration, and the funder, who is financing the arbitration. The funder will obviously want to be kept informed of developments in the arbitration, and the client will often want to consult the funder on strategic issues. I mean, after all, funders are repeat players in the arbitration space, and they often have valuable insights to offer. I think the best practice is to agree at the outset how the funder will be kept informed and consulted. And of course, I should note that if the funder is acquiring an equity stake in the claimant entity, some of these ethical issues can fall away because the funder will hold a often hold a directorship or another role within the company that allows it to participate in the company's decision-making processes regarding the arbitration.
Now, that's only one leg of that triangle. It gets even harder, doesn't it, when counsel has skin in the game, which is quite frequent, and funders often ask us to take a discount on our fees or some kind of cap, which is reimbursed on victory or, let's say, early settlement with a bonus. How, for example, would we deal with a situation where we stand to gain a substantial bonus on early settlement and a settlement offer is on the table? How can the client trust us?
I think we all have our professional obligations that we take, very, very seriously, and certainly in the context of third-party funding arrangements. The decision on settlement is often a decision that is taken with multiple people involved, including the potential for bringing on an independent QC or other lawyer to look at the settlement.
So one of the ways in which third-party funding came to the attention of the arbitration community was through a number of decisions of investment treaty arbitration tribunals with respect to disclosure and request by respondent states that the claimant disclose the source of its funding. Nick, can you talk us through the way in which some of those decisions have come out?
The starting point in that analysis, Noah, it seems to me, is really a very simple one. It is a question of whether the law or the applicable arbitration rules expressly require disclosure, and now some do. Where I'm sitting today in Singapore, the law requires disclosure in an international arbitration of the fact, though not the terms, of third-party funding. A very similar provision operates in Hong Kong law. So where those legal regimes have a role to play, notably where an arbitration is seated in either place, Singapore or Hong Kong, or where in the conduct of the arbitration council is governed by those regimes, as is true for Singapore and Hong Kong qualified lawyers and registered foreign lawyers in those places, then the answer to the question is a really very simple one. The law requires disclosure. To reiterate, disclosure of the fact of funding and the identity of the funder, but not the terms of the funding agreement. So in those regimes, the answer is simple. My own view is that reflects a broader direction of travel that has its problematic elements, and we'll return to some of those. But my own view is that is the future. Why is that, and where did the impulse for disclosure come from? I think originally it arose out of concerns about conflicts, in particular in the international arbitration context of arbitrators sitting on advisory boards and potentially even specifically reviewing investment proposals of funders, which gave rise to a concern that that may have happened in the background without disclosure. And of course, in reality, given the deep pool of both funders and arbitrators, the likelihood of there being a problem is very slim. But the problem, if it were to arise, would go to the core of the integrity of the process. So it is really out of that concern, I think, that an impulse for disclosure arose, and we now see in some parts of the world a requirement for disclosure. I should also say from the Singapore's perspective that the Singapore International Arbitration Centre rules for investment arbitration, though not the main commercial rules, but the rules for investment arbitration likewise require disclosure of third-party funding. Let me say one final thing about the impulse, what I'm calling the impulse to disclose. It is this: it can be extremely strategically beneficial. It can indicate to a respondent that the claimant is well-financed and serious about pursuing its claim. Its running out of money will not be a problem for its pursuit of its legal rights because it is backed by a funder. Not only that, it's backed by a funder that's decided the claim is good enough to warrant investing in it. And for obvious reasons, they can be important strategic messages to send.
Caroline, that sounds pretty straightforward in terms of the impulse. Are there any counterarguments that one could put forward as to why disclosure is not necessary or beneficial?
Claimants have sometimes been reluctant to disclose their arbitration finance arrangements out of a concern that it can trigger document disclosure requests and security for cost applications. And tribunals have consistently rejected those types of tactical applications. But still, these applications can add to the time and cost of the proceeding. And, you know, ultimately, arbitration finance is just one of many sources of financing that a company may have, and it can seem odd to disclose this type of financing and not others. So I'd say that the emergence of clearer rules on disclosure is a welcome development.
I think it has become clear from the discussion how important third-party funding is to our practice today, how complicated many of the issues are, and how important it is for us to gather information, to analyze it, and to understand the practices in the market with respect to the availability and the processes for locking down third-party funding, and also to understand the ethical and regulatory issues that third-party funding can raise. Well, thank you, Nick and Caroline, for a great discussion today, and I hope it was enjoyable to everyone who's out there listening.
Well, thank you, Noah.
Thanks, Noah. A pleasure.